You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
To conclude, Colossians 4, Paul writes this. He says, verse 2, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving. Pray for us as well, that God will open up a door for the word, so that we may speak the mystery of Christ, for which I have also been imprisoned. Remember, this was a prison letter, prison epistle. Pray that I may speak it clearly in the way I ought to speak. Conduct yourselves, this is for you, the people, conduct yourselves with wisdom toward those who are not believers, making the most of every opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. So, as Paul concludes, Christianity is not just some self-help religion for me, you know, making me a more loving person, making me kinder, giving me a better family, making me better at work, and so forth. This is actually a faith that is there and exists to go outward to people that don't know about this. This is what theologians refer to as evangelism. This is based on the Greek word euangelion. It just means good news. That what Jesus did when he died was good news. And as believers in Jesus, we want to do what Jesus did. Jesus was a preacher. I don't know if you knew that. Jesus walked around, an itinerant preacher, and he spoke to people. He spoke to large numbers of people. He spoke to individual people one-on-one. He would teach in parables. He would debate. He would dialogue. He was a speaker. And what he wanted to do was tell people about God's good news. Jesus said that he came to seek and to save that which was lost. And then he said, that was in Luke 19, John 20, 21, as the Father has sent me, I send you. And then later in Matthew 28, he says, go and make disciples of all nations. So why would we want to share our faith with other people? Because that's what Jesus did. And we're followers of him. Now, immediately as I share that, you might be asking the question, that's what the Bible teaches, but why? Why? Why do Christians feel the need to share their faith? Well, there's a number of philosophical presuppositions underneath that question that are implicit, that if you make them explicit, this makes a lot of sense. My friend went and traveled to Japan. In Japan, you don't tip. When you get food, when the server brings you the food, if you tip, it's considered rude. Now, if a Japanese person came here and you were the server and they didn't tip, that would be considered rude. Get it? So in our culture, it's tip if you don't rude. It's rude if you don't tip. And in Japanese culture, it's rude if you do. Why? Because in that culture, if you tip, what it means is you think the server isn't making enough money. And it's communicating actually disrespect to that individual. It's kind of like, I need to give you some charity because you're really kind of lesser than me. That presupposition, that assumption, that foundation in that culture would change a behavior where you see it in a new light. The same is true here as well. When we look at sharing our faith, when you think of the philosophical foundations for why we would do this, all of a sudden this makes a considerable amount of sense. For one, the contention that there is objective truth about God. When I say objective, I mean that there's truth in the object out there, not subjective truth, like truth in the subject here. Like if I said this, mint chocolate chip ice cream tastes good. I'm not speaking about the ice cream. I'm speaking about my taste. I'm speaking about the subject, not the object. But if I said mint chocolate chip ice cream is green, then I'm speaking about the object. And what I'm arguing here is that God is that way. There's truth about God. There's truths about God that we could say are either true or false, just like in every other area of life. Medicine, law, education, science, engineering, even dentistry. I don't know anything about dentistry. But dentistry, architecture, there's certain polymers, there's certain density that you use in the concrete that won't hold up the bridge if you don't get it right. Computer science, the only thing I know on computers is the on button in PowerPoint, and that's gotten me by so far to make a living, okay? But in each one of these areas, there's an objective truth, isn't there? You don't walk into a pharmacy and have bronchitis and pick the antibiotics based on the color of the pill. You know, I like blue. Blue's always worked well for me. You look for a double-blind test. You want to find out which one of those pills is actually going to do the job. Law, if you're caught speeding 85 and a 35, and you stand before the judge, and the judge says, what happened? And you said, well, Your Honor. Okay, now look. The sign said 35 mph. Now, I know you interpret that as miles per hour. I interpret that as marathons per hour. So I was well below the speed limit on that, okay? Now, obviously, there's a correct way to interpret that sign, and you're interpreting it objectively wrong. Education, if you take the ACTs, SATs, there's a right answer and a wrong answer. I mean, we could go right on down the line. Here's my point. Why would we use an approach to knowledge and reality in every other area of life? Like there's an objective truth in medicine, and there's an objective truth in law, an objective truth in education, and in science, in architecture. There's an objective truth everywhere, and we'd use that everywhere except the most important area of life, which is God. The existence of God is by far the most important area, and I think it is totally discriminatory to say we're going to use a method of knowledge in every area of life except for the most important area. Second, we can know objective truth about God, not just that it exists, but we can know that it exists. Just like every other area of life, we can look into this, we can study it and look at the claims and counterclaims and evidence and counter-evidence and the fallacies that are involved in learning about truth. When you think about Christianity is the one religion that is testable and falsifiable. So if you're here tonight and you're looking into exploring what you believe, I would say, if you're into that, start with Christianity. And right there, you're like, you lost me. You're a Bible teacher. Of course, you would say explore Christianity. No, I mean that seriously. Because Christianity, you could say the biggest religion, the religion that's changed the world, forever, okay? The big kahuna. You could check that off your list very easily. How? Many ways. You could falsify it in many ways. Show that there is no such thing as a soul. If you could disprove the existence of the soul, you could disprove Christianity. If you could show that there is some kind of logical incoherence in the nature of God, like in God's omnipresence and omniscience and omnipotence, if you could show that, you could disprove Christianity. If you could show that Jesus never existed, Jesus Christ, then you would get rid of Christianity. If you could show that Jesus never rose from the dead, you could get rid of Christianity. Christianity would be toast if you could do this. So we can know truth about God, and there's good evidence for belief in God. I remember talking to one guy recently, and he's like, yeah, but we can't really know if God's real or not. And I'm like, oh, of course we can. Obviously we can. He said, what do you mean we can't? He said, it's not like there's evidence for it. I said, oh, there's tons of evidence for it. He said, like what? I was like, oh, the cosmological arguments, the teleological arguments, the moral arguments, intentional states of consciousness, free will, objective morality, archaeology, predictive prophecy, the arguments for the resurrection. I went on and on and on. He's like, okay, stop. Okay, uncle, right? I'm like, there's a lot of evidence. And you can look into all that, and it's there. It's there for the taking. I think it is. If you look into the case for Christianity, watch out, because you are going to be, I don't know if you're going to be convinced, you will definitely be impressed. The amount of evidence there is for God and the God of the Bible. Finally, if there is an objective truth and we can know truth about God, it seems to me that it's incumbent on us to share that truth with others. Just like in every other area of life. Imagine tonight you're walking down on Indianola and a car stops. And they say, hey, we're going to a concert and it's downtown. And, you know, we paid big bucks for this concert, but we can't find it. Which way is downtown? How do I get there from here? Well, downtown is south, right? Right? Yeah. Downtown, you got to take Summit and that turns into Third, or you can take 71 South. But what kind of a person would you be if you said, oh, North 4th? You should go north, yeah. Or you should go perpendicular and just get weird with it, okay? Right? Or imagine if you were there and your buddy said, oh, well, you know, really any road will get you there. Like any path will get you there downtown to your concert where you paid $500 and you want to have a joyful evening. That person would look at you like a terror. Like what is wrong with people in Columbus? Why would you talk like that? You know, I'm asking for your help. How do you get downtown? There's an objective place, and there's a way to get there. It's real. And for you to say, well, I don't know, it's really your opinion. See, I just think that that lacks all credibility. I don't believe that. So this question, I think, is predicated on a false assumption. Why do Christians feel the need to share their faith? See, that's subjective speak, right? I feel like I should do that. This isn't about how I feel it that way or not. It's Christians need to, based on what? Based on objective truth existing, based on being able to know it, and being able to share about it. Now, how do we do this in a way that's not totally gross and bizarre as we've seen in our culture today? If you've been out in the Christian world at all, like me, you just feel so grossed out by the things that you see when people, Christian people, try and share their faith. Sometimes it's just so creepy, you don't even know what to do with it. Well, we're at a Bible study. Let's read it right out of the Bible. I think we could condense what Paul says into three key lessons. Here's one lesson I see. This just jumps right off the page. When you're sharing your faith, begin by talking to God. This is in every verse in the first three verses. Devote yourselves to prayer. Pray for us that God would open up a door for the word. Pray that I might make it clear in the way that I ought to speak. Prayer, pray, pray. When you think about this idea of talking to people about God, where do we start? Paul says it's like when the doctor hits your knee with that stupid hammer, and it hits your knee and you have that reaction. If you asked Paul, what do you do when you share your faith? He would just be like, pray, 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 pray. The trifecta, right away, pray, pray, pray. Why? Why would we pray? Why not just go out and speak? Because, according to the Bible, this idea of seeing people come to a knowledge of Christ is an impossible task. Jesus was the one who said, apart from me, you can do nothing. Paul, in reflecting on this in another letter, 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 16, he said, who is adequate for such a task? And his implicit answer is no one. No one is adequate to do this. So it makes me laugh. Like, I don't audibly laugh or maybe even smile when people say this to me. I keep a straight face. But when people come up to me and they fellow Christians and they say things like, yeah, you know, I don't like to share my faith because I'm just not very good at it. You know, or like, it seems like when I share, like, no one's really that interested. You know what I mean? Or like, sometimes I feel like kind of nervous. Like, if somebody says something to me, I'm not going to know what to say and I'm going to sound stupid. And for me, on the inside, in my heart, I'm like, yeah. You don't know what you're doing. You will sound stupid. No one is interested. No one is wanting to come to God on their own natural ability. However, talking to God about this changes everything. No, you're not good at explaining this on your own. Yeah, we all know that. Neither am I. No one is. Paul wasn't. This was the guy that when he walked into a church, he would sneeze, or he'd walk into a city, he would sneeze and a new church would erupt, okay? This is the guy who's saying, who's adequate for these things? Only through Christ do we have adequacy, qualification to do this. When you talk to God, people that were naturally like, I don't want anything to do with God, all of a sudden want to hear about God. people that are very timid become very bold. It's very strange to watch. When you pray, doors open where you're just like, I don't think that person would ever be interested. And then you pray for them. And then 6 weeks later, you show up to a meeting like this and they're sitting across the room. And you're like, I prayed for you. How did you get here? Well, you know, my friend from class invited me out. How did that happen? Talking to God. That's how. Somebody was speaking to them. The real question is, does prayer work or not? Does it work? If prayer doesn't work, don't do it. What a colossal and embarrassing waste of time than to sit by yourself every day speaking up to the ceiling when no one's listening, and even if somebody is listening, they have no intention of responding to your prayers, and or maybe they don't have the power to even answer your prayers. Don't pray. However, if the Bible is true, we have every reason to pray. I want you just to think about this with me, okay? When you read the Bible, when you have the biggest, spontaneous, powerful moments, what precipitated those moments? Like when Elijah was there in 1 Kings 18, and he's there with the 450 prophets of Baal, the false god. They were throwing their infant babies on his statue, burning these children alive. And Elijah was doing a face-off, one prophet of God versus 450 prophets of Baal. And they pray all day and all night, and they're slashing themselves. And Elijah gives one prayer, just one. That's all it was. God, you're there. I know you're real. Toast this thing, smoke this bone here, and then we're all going to see that you're real. And skadoosh, boom, fire from heaven. And everyone saw it. How do you get fire to come down from heaven? Prayer. What makes demons flee in terror? Imagine if there was like a gun, like a Ghostbusters gun, circa 1988, okay? Like a Ghostbusters gun that you could buy and you could shoot a demon, and when you shot it, it was like, and just like kind of whimpered out of the room. Like imagine if that existed. Would you buy one? I'd buy 20. I'd buy one for all my friends. You know, wouldn't that be awesome? Like if there was demons and you had a gun, prayer can do this. When you pray, demons must flee. Satan himself must flee. What raises people from the dead? Prayer. Prayer does. Peter in Acts 9 raises this woman. Well, her one name is Dorcas, but then they renamed her Tabitha for obvious reasons, right? And she's this old lady, and she died, and the old ladies were like, Peter, she was such a good woman. She used to serve and love people. Peter prayed over her, and she came back to life. What did Jesus do when he was on earth? He prayed constantly. If the Son of God is praying constantly, that should show you something right there. If he does it, if he did it, that means how much more should we do it? You with me? In the words of James, he says in James 5, prayer has, quote, great power and produces wonderful results. What other thing do we do in life as Christians that could be said to have great power and produce wonderful results? I challenge you to find anywhere in the Bible some activity in which we engage that could be said to result in great power and wonderful results. Prayer. I'm not saying prayer is the only thing we do any more than the only thing we do is eat. I'm saying prayer is the most important thing that we do. It is the most important thing that we do. It is the most important thing that we do. Like eating doesn't seem very sexy every day. You know what I mean? Like I eat my sandwich and it's just like, this doesn't seem, like, am I really doing that much? But if I don't do that, I die. If you don't pray, imagine you don't pray, you're spiritually going to lose it. You're going to lose it. And you're going to be powerless to make an impact on others. Prayer has incredible results. I believe this. I believe this all the way down to my soul that this is true. I had a roommate back in the day. This guy was wild. He was a wild man. And I came to Christ in November, and we argued for 6 months about Christianity. And it wasn't even like, I don't want you to get the idea that it was like these two like sharp, responsible, educated men talking. We were both 20 and ignorant and stoned half the time, okay? Yeah, that's where we were coming from. And we were arguing about Christianity, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then we got to the point where we were just like so tense with each other that it just got into like arguments about stupid stuff. And that the straw that broke the camel's back was this day. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was vivid. I was sitting at our table in our little place on 289 East 14th Avenue. And he was arguing to me that we should give marijuana to elementary school kids to help them with their ADHD. And I was arguing, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. And we went back and forth, back and forth. Finally, I blew up. I stormed out of the room. He stormed out the back door. I went up into my bedroom and I had a stress nap. Okay, that's what I do when I get really angry. Like I was just like, I need to sleep. So I went upstairs and I laid down in bed and I heard him, you know, walking down the gravel driveway, and I was just so angry and honestly sad. I was sad. I was sensing this is my best friend. Our relationship is on life support. It's real bad. And I just cried out to God in frustration. I was just like, I didn't pray. I wasn't good at praying. I was bad at praying. I was bad at everything back then. And I just prayed. I was like, God, I was like, okay, I know I don't talk to you as much as I should. I just pray you would do something in this guy's life. You know what I mean? Like, I can't do it anymore. I give up, and I pray you would send somebody to go deal with him because I can't do it. I'm done. Went to sleep, woke up, and it was home church. Home church, man. I was excited. I was like, I got my car. I drove to home church. I parked the car, walk up on the porch. Guess who's standing there? Is my friend Chris Hardy. Okay. He's on the porch, nervous as anything. Never seen him so nervous. He's chain-smoking cigarettes, looking at me. And I'm trying to play it cool, right? Because I don't want him to feel weird. So I'm like, hey, everything's normal, right? You know, you're here at a Bible study, and we've been talking about this for 6 months, and we just yell at each other, and you're here. So everything's good. I leave, and later I talk to my buddy Brian, and I'm like, Brian, the guy led me to Christ. I'm like, I can't believe Chris was here. How'd that happen? He goes, you won't believe it. Earlier today, I was in a bar, Bernie's, on 16th, and he said I was walking out of the stairs in the basement of the bar, and Chris was coming down from 14th Avenue on High Street, and we literally bumped into each other. He saw Chris. He's like, Chris, I haven't seen you for a while. How you doing? Small talk, small talk. Hey, you should come out to home church tonight. You'd love it. You'd have a great time. Chris didn't have a job, wasn't going to school. He had nothing going on in his life. He had no excuses, so he's like, all right. So he showed up, and then I remembered, I was like, wait a minute, I prayed. I prayed God would send somebody to go talk to him because I was just fed up with him and I couldn't deal with him. What time was that? 2:30. I prayed at 2 o'clock. Prayed at 2 o'clock. And within a month, Chris had come to Christ. And now he's one of our pastors here at our church 20 years later. You might not recognize him. That's kind of an old, scraggly picture. But I got some real pictures here that I thought I'd show. Just to be clear, those are definitely not AI pictures where I punched in what I thought would make it look like Chris and the way he looks now. And those are all the same person. So I just want to be clear on that. Prayer has great power and produces wonderful results. And it opens up doors. Opens up doors. In May of 2015, I was on staff here, and I was like, you know, God, I was praying a lot. I was like, God, I feel like I love what I do, and I love being here, but I'm in this like Christian culture and Christian bubble, and I don't know people that don't know you, and I want to share about you to people that don't know you. So I prayed for a week. This is how strong of a man of prayer I am, okay? It was like only a week long, but it was every day. And I was like, I don't know how this is going to work, God, but I just pray you would open up a door so that you could like use me to share about your love with somebody out there. Week goes by. I open up Facebook Messenger, and a dear loved one wrote me this message. Hey, James, I have kind of a personal question, but I felt like you were the person I'm supposed to ask. I edited some stuff out here that was personal. All right. My question is, when you ask God's forgiveness for something, how are you supposed to know when he's actually forgiven you? Sorry to ask over Facebook. She was apologizing to me for asking, how do I come to know Christ? I don't have your phone number. So I wrote back a message. You know, Christianity is about what God has done for us, not what we do for him. That's why Jesus took up the cross. That's the whole message of the Bible. It's mercy, God's mercy. It's not about self-righteousness, the deeds that we do for God, righteousness in yourself. It's about God's righteousness through Christ coming down to us and admitting that you are sinful, that you need forgiveness. And then the most important part is that you need to receive that forgiveness into your life. And it's not enough if it was paid for. You got to actually accept that gift of forgiveness. She wrote back a day later, thank you so much for writing all that. Taking the time out of your day to do so made me feel special and cared about. Your message made me feel a lot better well after I prayed and then cried for a really long time. I know that wasn't a coincidence. Thank you for being the conduit that helped me reconnect with Jesus and with God. I love you too, James. Prayer works. Prayer is real. Let me say it again. If prayer doesn't work, don't do it. But if what the Bible says about prayer is true, this is where it's at. You might be like, I don't know why my Christian life is so boring. I don't know why everything is just so lackluster. Everyone else seems so excited about everything, and I just don't seem to have anything else going on in my life. Try praying every day that God would open up doors for you to take risks for him, and you're going to see your life just totally blossom. This is very real, very serious, and God gets behind it. Secondly, what Paul says that I think we could take from this passage is that we need to develop a winsome lifestyle. He says in verse 5, conduct yourself with wisdom toward those who are not believers. Conduct. Peripateo is the word. It means to walk, like the way you walk, the way you live. People can see it. So your conduct yourselves, that's within your control, with what? With wisdom. Toward whom? Toward people that don't believe. So they see your lifestyle and they go, whoa, something's different over there. Making the most of every opportunity. The word here in Greek is agoreo. Agoras were like big places you'd have concerts and markets. X means from. So he's like, go into the agora and just buy up everything you can, is what he's saying. Only it's your life. Making the most of every opportunity means like buying up every moment in your life to be around people that don't know God. Watch what opportunities appear when you serve and love others. When you get into this, when you're like, my life is about being a witness for Jesus Christ. That when people see me, they may have never read a Bible, but they see me. And they look at me and they know that I'm associated with Christ. When you begin to love and serve others, watch and see the opportunities that open right up. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. One case was a medical doctor. He was terrified to share his faith. So scared. And, you know, rich, smart, tall, good-looking guy. I mean, he had everything going for him. It's like, but he would try and talk about Christ, and he got so gummed up, he didn't know what to say. Here's what he did. He joined a volunteer medical group in the city. He began to use his strengths, which was giving out medical advice and treating people. He began to share about Christ with hundreds of people per year. It was like he was in his wheelhouse and he was helping, serving people and building them up and, you know, healing them. And then he was just like, and I got to tell you something else that's going to heal you. It's about God, and God loves you so much, and he's real, and he wants to come into your life. Man, if you're tonight and you're a believer in Jesus, you have gifts. One guy I talked to, you're like, well, I'm not a medical doctor. Stop. One guy I talked to, he was a plumber and a pipe fitter. He could help people change their oil. Like, nobody knows how to do that anymore. And I'm like, dude, you know how to do stuff on cars. And he's like, yeah, I know how to do everything with cars. And I'm like, you can like fix problems in people's houses and you can like rebuild things. You know, nobody knows how to do that in our era, right? Like nobody. If you only did that and then shared about Christ with that, dude, you're like a sleeping giant. You're a sleeping giant. I know there's people sitting here that you're like, I've got gifts that I could use to serve other people. But, you know, I don't know about like if I could share about Christ. Dude, do it. Go for it. Share and serve at the same time. And you see right there, making the most of every opportunity as you conduct yourselves with wisdom. Finally, number three, grow as a communicator. We got to pray. We've got to love and serve. But then we need to speak. And we can grow in this, just like we can grow in anything else. Paul says, let your speech also, or rather always, there I am, great communicator, can't even read. Let your speech always be with grace as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. Learning. This means that you need to read books, not just online, not just, you know, oh, I've read an article on that or I read this. You need to buy books. There's no way around this. You need to become a reader. And as you do this, you learn more about your faith, what you believe, why you believe it, and then all of a sudden you know how you should respond to each individual person. This develops out of that, that when you learn the content, all of a sudden you learn how to actually use it in real life. Then he says in verse 4, part of this again is prayer. Pray that I might make it clear in the way that I ought to speak. Making it clear. And I'm not very good at this, honestly. But this last month, we went to Florida. We were out playing a pickup game of basketball. 3-on-3, played a couple games. This guy walks up, 18 years old. And he had chains and piercings and tattoos. And it was like 90 degrees out. And he was dressed all in black. And I'm like, I don't know what's going on. And he's like, can I play? And we're like, sure, man. Yeah. Come on in. He was terrible at basketball. Okay. I don't know what he was doing. But he came in and he like, we played a couple games. And then I got tired. And I sat out. And then he sat out with me. So we were talking. So I was like, hey, we're with a church group. And, you know, are there any good churches in the area? Well, he got really downcast, you know. You can imagine. He goes, no, all the churches I have been to are very judgmental. So I said, well, I'm sure you believe in God, don't you? I mean, there's lots of evidence for God. God's real. And he said, yeah, I do believe in God, actually. And we were off to the races, and we started talking about, you know, fine-tuning of the universe and the origin of the universe. And then eventually he kept bringing up free will, so we were talking about that. And then evil and suffering. And we finally got down to a point in the conversation where I realized this guy has been hurt. So I said, I think your main issue is the problem of evil. Do you feel that way? And he said, yeah, problem of evil. I said, well, there's good news with Christianity. In all other religions, God says, you suffer, I'll watch. You suffer, I'll watch. In Christianity, God says, you suffer, and I'll suffer with you. And better than that, I'll suffer for you. I was like, dude, Jesus was hung up on a cross. They put nails through his wrists and his ankles. He couldn't breathe. He was stripped naked. He's bleeding. He was killed. I said, what does that show us? It shows us that God didn't leave us in suffering. He entered into it. It's unbelievable. It's the best news you've ever heard. He thought about that and he said, well, what if the disciples, though, just made up this whole thing? Like, I believe Jesus died on the cross and he existed. I believe that. But what if the disciples made this whole thing up as a joke and then they spread it and that's why we believe it today? And I don't know where this came from, but out of my mouth, I said this. I said, so-and-so, if this was a joke, the punchline would not be a crucifixion victim. He got the biggest smile on his face. And he said, that is a very good point. And I was like, thank you. Cool. And then, you know, we went our separate ways. And I have to tell you, just to confess, I left that conversation pretty proud of myself. I was like, the things coming out of my mouth were just, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I finally didn't argue, get into a debate. It was sensitive and gentle and loving and compassionate. And I was saying things I didn't know where they were coming from. I don't know. I couldn't explain it. And I'm like, I am really good at this now. Like, I didn't know that. I'm really good at this. It wasn't until we got back into the car that my friend that was there with me, who was standing next to me the whole time, he said, "What do you think about that conversation?" I was like, "That was amazing, man. That's unbelievable." He said, "Yeah, I didn't know what to say, so I just prayed for you the whole time." And I prayed for him too. Then I realized, no wonder, no wonder, no wonder I was able to communicate in a way that was respectful and clear and loving and kind, because there was somebody right there. What a picture. Isn't that an amazing picture? Somebody right next to you praying for you the whole time. His name is Bonk. He's sitting right over there. He's single, ladies. He's right there. Great guy. Uh, 40-minute teaching for one punchline. all right. Let's wrap this up. All right. If you're here tonight and, you know, you're not a believer in Jesus and you're kind of figuring this out and you've had strange experiences with Christians coming up to you talking about Jesus, I get it. I've been there. I remember being a Christian walking on campus, and we were walking to class, me and my buddy, and this Christian came up to, and I don't know how I just knew, but I knew this guy, he's coming for us. He had that look in his eye and he came at us and he's like, "Hey," he said, "Hi, what's your name?" I'm like, James. And he's like, I'm like, "What's your name?" He's like, "Whatever." And so then he's like, "Hey, do you got a minute?" And I'm like, "I really don't. I got to get to class." And he goes, "When I say Jesus, what do you say?" You know, I'm like, okay. I'm like, "Which group are you with?" And it was a group here on campus and stuff. It's a nice Christian group. But I was just like, how impersonal? You know what I mean? It's like getting a telemarketer calling you. You know what I mean? Like, you feel like even the sweetest telemarketer, you're like, you're reading from a script. And you're trying to get something from me. And it just, the whole thing felt weird. And if you're here tonight and that's been your experience, let me just say this. That is not what we read from the Bible. Okay? That was somebody being weird, somebody being strange. But that's not what we read here. What we're seeing here is prayer, gentleness, love, compassion, communication, patience, clarity. So if you're here tonight, please, please don't let this person hold you hostage from coming to know Jesus just because you had a bad experience. Be a bad, bad move, man. And finally, if you haven't shared your faith in a while, would you pray tonight? Would you pray here tonight that God would open up a door for you to take a risk? Would you pray this for the next week? I dare you to do that. I dare you to pray every day, "God, I pray you'd open up a door for me to share your forgiveness and love with somebody," and see what God will do with prayers like that.